This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's an international break, but we've pulled out all the stops. We'll do a bit of England, speculate on whether Southgate's loyalty will ever end, and wonder if players are more likely to get picked if they've got 3 million Instagram followers. There's the home nations all trying to qualify, and then we get interesting. Trips to Mongolia and Pakistan's first home game since 2014. And without giving any publicity to other football podcasts, the host of The Price of Football, Kevin Day, and Kieran Maguire have written a book about football ownership, so we'll chat to them. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Ed Ahrens, how are you?
Very good, Max. How are you?
Nice to see you. Robin Cowan, welcome.
Hi, Max. I'll be performing the role of Barry Glendening today and not really right. Understanding why I'm here.
Oh, really good. Well, good luck with that. And occasionally saying, I don't care, or bits that don't make the edit, which are, that's a stupid question, ask me another one. But you're welcome to do those. Paul Watson, hello.
Hi, Max.
Sort of an international break regular. This is, you know.
I know it's an international break, but I get the message and I'm like, oh, God, is it coming up again?
Listen, every squad needs one, right? It's absolutely huge. On the subject of Barry, Michael says, has Barry been called up for international duties? Lang says, Glenning's absence is suspicious. Can we please have a word from Barry's agent, whether he's been contacted by Birmingham City? We did mention it a couple of weeks ago at the end of the pod. Clearly, no one listens that far to this nonsense. He's on a month sabbatical. He very recently, seconds ago, tweeted a picture of himself standing next to an elephant where he looks quite sad and quite sweaty, but he has yet to paint this elephant. So hopefully that is how it remains. So England then, top of Group C. They play Italy on Tuesday and they've got the Socceroos on Friday night at 7:45. They've got a 6-point lead over Italy, who do have a game in hand. On Saturday against Malta. So presuming they win that, then Tuesday's game might be a little bit spicy. One of the interesting things to come out of this squad, Robin, I guess it's sort of Southgate and loyalty again with Maguire and Henderson still there. And I have a theory, and I'd like to test it on the three of you, which is that he is sticking with the guys that will get the job done. And then once qualified, he will experiment or even let them go, set them free, and then bring in your sort of Ward-Prowse, Rico Lewis, Tomori, etc., with a bit less pressure on them. Agree or disagree?
I'd love to see it, personally. I can't see him doing that, to be honest. It's just not been his pattern of behaviour. I'm still absolutely baffled why Harry Maguire and Jordan Henderson are still there. I'd like it, though. I mean, and that would be really out of character, wouldn't it? We think?
Yeah, it would be very surprising. I mean, he's very loyal to players and we've seen that obviously with Calvin Phillips as well, who's still in the squad, even though what number choice is he at Man City in centre mid after the weekend? I think that's been the secret to his success in a way, that the sort of consistency of selection throughout his time as manager has really helped players. But I don't know, maybe it's time to mix it up a little bit now that they're, you know, pretty much qualified and there's quite a lot of time to experiment.
Yeah, I think, you make a good point about Calvin Phillips. It seems strange. I think last pod, Paul, we were criticised for being a bit negative about Southgate. Perhaps the first time, I'm very much a Southgate apologist, I think is what they're called. You know, I really believe like, this is the second most successful England manager of all time. He deserves the chance to lead us to the Euros, to semi-final pain or whatever he leads us to. But I did feel he's sort of got a bit chippy last time. And we wonder if we sort of started to see the, you know, this good ship just slightly faltering, and perhaps we shouldn't be so critical given, you know, we will qualify barring some disaster.
Yeah, it's funny. Apologist is quite a negative word.
It is, yes. But am I disciple? I'm not sure.
You know, I'd be in the same boat, actually. I think any of us who are old enough to have watched England over a number of years can't help but find it slightly amusing to see people's anger and, you know, venting this frustration at an England team that is waltzing to qualification and, you know, will be amongst the favourites to win a World Cup, which is something that, you know, when we used to watch us labouring to a 2-1 win in wherever it was, you know, Moldova. And
of all the people you should be able to come up with a small team, Paul, off the top of your head.
The thing was, the ones popping into my head were unlikely, like Macau or Sri Lanka. Yeah, but yeah, you know, I think having seen past England teams and, you know, also how he a lot of the time has conducted himself as a man, as a leader, it does seem very harsh that people are judging him in this way. But this is the crazy thing about international management, I think, is that at tournaments, it's really quite random. You know, maybe random is not quite the word, but you have so few games and the result of those games is so massive, whether you're a success or a failure. So we have this enormous protracted process of getting to the World Cup, and whether he is seen as a massive failure or success will be dependent on one or two incidents, probably, in one or two games. And so it's really hard to say, isn't it? At this point, whether you know, this is all a master plan, he's creating this very strong unit that will then go on to success, or whether he should be experimenting, and that people will only know when they're wise after the event.
Yeah, the issue for me is that in all cases, it's just a lack of decent alternatives, really. And I think with Maguire, now that Stones is back, I don't want to preempt Gareth, but I think we might see Gay and Stones tested as a partnership, and that is...
Or Dunk? Would you say? Or no?
I'm a Crystal Palace fan. No, absolutely. Potentially. But I think the balance of Gay plays on the left and Stones is what he's hoping will be the centre-back partnership, potentially, or maybe not. You know, there's a lot of time to go. But the real issue, I think, is because also you had Colwill who could come into that reckoning. But I think the real issue is in centre mid, where actually Bellingham, as good as he is, has created a bit of a problem because he's now playing more advanced for Real Madrid, scoring all these goals. Whereas before he was hoping perhaps he was going to be our, you know, number eight ball playing midfielder running the game. But now we've just got another number 10 and we have, you know, so many already. We have Maddison and Kane who drops back into that position as well, playing up front. And then, you know, plenty of other players, Foden as well. But that's actually what I'd like to see, Foden given a chance in a much deeper position. So he can control the game a bit more. But
ooh, that's interesting.
Gareth and Pep don't seem to see him like that. But, you know, back when he was playing for the under-17s, that's what he was doing. He was the number eight, really, playing the ball from deep. Because we don't really have anyone like that still. And that's
the big problem. Ward-Prowse is a bit unlucky then.
Yeah, Ward-Prowse potentially. But is he of good enough quality to win a tournament in that position? Probably, no offence, probably not. Good technician with his free kicks, but... You're talking about somebody like Modric to, you know, run the game, and I mean he's a one in a million, but yeah.
So I guess what you're saying, you know, if there's a three, right, and Rice is one and Bellingham is one, and you probably, if you're putting round pegs in round holes, which obviously very few England managers have ever done, then Maddison's unlucky because Bellingham is playing there, right? You couldn't bring, when you could bring Bellingham deeper, Maddison does drop for Spurs, but that would be. It would be risky, right? And actually, if you look at Arsenal, their midfield is better when Rice has somebody next to him who's a bit boring, like Jorginho or Partey or something.
Yeah, well, that's the other option. I mean, yeah, I suppose against the best teams, you probably do need two holding ones, in which case Phillips is really good at that, isn't he? He can do both roles. And somebody like Mount, who is really off form at the moment, I think long-term they were thinking he could be that person, but it's not. It's not looking good at the moment. So, yeah, it's a real issue. Unless they could develop another sort of Rice to go alongside him, and then that would really free up Bellingham to do what he wanted and the front three as well. But, yeah, it's an issue with the just quality of those midfielders, which we've always had.
And now there is a fullback crisis, Paul. You know, in times we had an 11 of right-backs at one point. I'm sure there was we could have picked 11. I think if you picked Max Aarons, you could get 11 right backs at one point. And then we had, you had Shaw and Chilwell who were they're two good left backs. And now you're left with Kyle Walker and Kieran Trippier, which is fine. I mean, that's good, but it's quite interesting how that injury can really affect the squad.
Yeah, it's often that way, isn't it? You only really realise that suddenly you're really quite short in a position quite suddenly, and you think, well, there must be someone else, and you're running through the names thinking, there really isn't, is there? But I would say that that's true of a lot of nations, and a lot of nations that go on to win tournaments, actually their squad isn't deep in every single area, because I just don't think that's realistically possible. And so I wouldn't say it's a cause for enormous concern. I actually really like Trippier as well. I think I don't have any huge worry about him. So yeah, it's not ideal, but I would say you look through any team in the build up to the World Cup, you'll find some a little Achilles heel in there that you think, ooh, it's just because we're England, we already see it and see it dooming us. Whereas other nations are probably like, yeah, but it'll be fine.
Well, do you know what we've amazingly managed to do is not say the name of the player regards fullback or midfield that is named all the time and gets more coverage than all other footballers on earth. Ed, your thumb is up.
Trent,
could he do that? He did do that job in midfield.
Did you mean Tyreek Mitchell?
Could Trent Alexander-Arnold could do that midfield thing next to Rice?
Potentially, but yeah, I mean, he's not playing there for his club, so
true.
Makes it very difficult. I mean, he did it against Malta brilliantly, and yeah, but that was Malta. But yeah, potentially he could. I think that's the only way he's going to get in the England team, isn't it? Let's be honest. He's not going to play right back because
no,
he's just not trusted by Gareth, and you know they don't play that system.
Quite an interesting interview with Ollie Watkins with David Heitner in the paper. And he could feature against Australia. I mean, Kane tends to play all the time, doesn't he? But Ollie Watkins said, I think I go under the radar. I'm not talked about enough profile-wise. I know I've been producing on the pitch since Unai Emery came in, but it goes under the radar. He doesn't have an account on Twitter or X. He has done 11 Instagram posts since the start of the season to 373,000 followers. He said, a lot of people have said to me, I need to push my profile. A guy I work with commercially is always saying to post more on Instagram. It's kind of, I wouldn't want to put myself out there that's not authentic and not myself. I mean, clearly, Robin, that shouldn't matter, should it? And I mean, I can't see, I don't think Gareth Southgate would care. But do you think there is this kind of implied thing that, Callum Wilson is sort of equivalent level of player? He does a podcast, I don't know what his following is, but do you think that actually makes any difference?
Well, you'd hope it wouldn't make a difference in terms of selection, but in terms of endearing maybe to the sort of the fan of England who just watch the England games, there may be, because yeah, as you say, Callum Wilson, you hear from him a lot, he's got his own podcast, you see him out there a bit more. I think it's really depressing that that's the state of affairs we're in, though. As a professional athlete, you should just, if you want to just concentrate on that side and not have to worry about your social media presence, that's absolutely fine. But then you do get like James Maddison, who posted, I think yesterday, about, it was very funny, about Trent still asking for another replay, for the Spurs-Liverpool game. And that's kind of, we quite like that, don't we, as sort of consumers, because it kind of shows their lighter side. And James Maddison's obviously very good at that. I'd hope it's nothing to do with, how you're perceived in terms of as a footballer, but maybe it is to us. But I don't think hopefully Gareth Southgate's not, well, you're not getting enough numbers on your, no, you're not getting enough retweets, right. I'm afraid. So
this might be a stretch, Paul, but this idea that, if you have got a great social media profile, that you will endear yourself to fans so that when you're on the pitch, you are more likely to get a nice reception, and it's easier to play if everyone is behind you rather than if they are, I suppose, indifferent. People aren't going to be furious with Ollie Watkins because he hasn't done an Insta story about, going to Dubai or, buying his wife a handbag or something.
I buy into it to a certain point. I'd almost come at it from an opposite perspective. If you're a coach, I'd imagine you quite like players that just shut up and get on with the job. I imagine what you don't really want is players that are either distracted or seem distracted by their other concerns. Although I think, to be honest, players have enough time and energy to also do whatever they want on social media and play football. But I imagine as a coach, what you don't necessarily want is players who maybe are going out and venting a lot about what's going on within the camp. I'd say those are the players that as a coach, you'd think, I'm not sure I necessarily like that you're airing every single thought you have about anything, and it I cannot see Southgate as a real kind of slightly old school football-y kind of man caring at all about social media in a positive sense. I could see him thinking, let's shut it down if players are talking too much or if he feels they're distracted. But no, I agree that I think fans are very malleable by social media, and it's a big part of a player's role now, I think, is how they engage with fans. But I don't think it's a selection issue.
I did get a social media manager for a month many years ago who told me, it was sort of quite painful, that sort of told me I should be posting at certain times, like just before shows, like when I'm at my most relevant. So I should have like tweeted a picture before the podcast saying I'm just about to go live.
The time of day that you're most relevant has really scared me. It's like a Black Mirror type thing, isn't it?
What a grim idea. When am I most relevant? I mean, I don't think ever, really. Let's be brutally honest.
About 15 years ago?
Yeah, probably. You're absolutely right. No, absolutely right. About 2008. And it's hard to tweet from then, isn't it? Like, I can't go back in time. England have requested to go through qualification for Euro 2028, despite hosting the tournament. Good idea, or, I mean, absolute recipe for fucking disaster, isn't it? Like, you could just see it. Oh, no. What are you doing? That is a risk, but, you know, anyway. Wembley, the Principality Stadium, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, the Etihad, Everton Stadium, their new one, St James's Park, Villa Park, Hampden Park, the Aviva in Dublin and Casement Park in Belfast are the stadia that are going to be used. I don't know if the other home nations have said, oh, we'll qualify too. I can't imagine. But they're probably going, you know, we'll take the spot if we can. So we played the Socceroos on Friday. Graham Arnold got Gus Hiddink and Ange to turn up and say hello to the players. I don't know how many ex. Any international manager would get two relatively successful ex-managers back in to say hello. It's quite a nice video that they
Ben popping in.
Yeah.
with Kevin Keegan.
In. Yeah. Kev, he's got some excellent views on football at the moment. Yeah, he'd be really good to get in. And I suppose there's a memories, Ed, of 2003, you know, when Sven made 10 changes at halftime. International debuts to Rooney, Paul Konchesky, I think Franny Jeffers as well, when we lost to Australia.
Yeah, I remember it not very well, but yeah, I do remember it. And well, I think, yeah, it was Rooney and Jeffers were supposed to be the strike partnership for the next decade, weren't they? But I didn't really work out like that. Only one of them did well. Yeah, it should be an interesting game. I'm going to Wembley on Friday. It'd be good to see Australia, how they get on with a new generation of players that they've got at the moment.
They don't have any superstars right now, do they? But well, good luck to them. It's thought that a message of peace and unity will be conveyed before the game on Friday. The FA are going to announce their plans today following the horrific and like totally heartbreaking loss of civilian life both in Israel and Gaza. According to the BBC, the FA is unlikely to light the Wembley Arch in the colours of the Israel flag because of fears of a backlash from many following Israel's response to the deadly attack on innocent Israelis by Hamas, following the siege on Gaza and the increasing numbers of innocent casualties there. The FA, the Premier League and individual clubs have not made any statement about it. The Guardian understands senior executives within football who are Jewish reached out to the FA on Wednesday to urge it to speak up or in some way commemorate the loss of life in the Hamas attacks. The Department for Culture, Media and Sport, the British government, said in the light of the attacks in Israel, on behalf of the Secretary of State, we'd encourage you to mark the events in line with previous events where sport has come together. Keir Starmer also said the Wembley Arch should be lit up. Meanwhile, Arsenal have spoken to their squad about the wider implications of posting messages around the conflict on social media. Ukraine fullback Oleksandr Zinchenko published a post saying, I stand with Israel. Egypt midfielder Mohamed Elneny has changed his profile pictures on social media to a Palestine flag. Neither player has been told to remove the posts or profile pictures. They've been made aware of what the reaction and impact could be from those who view them. I was looking at our downloads in the last month. We've had loads from Israel and loads from Palestine, and we just send you our love and we hope you are okay. This podcast isn't the place that will have the answers to this, and perhaps people come to this podcast as well for an escape. I hope that is not us excusing talking about this issue, but sort of feel whatever the FA do, they will or don't do, they will get criticism from somewhere. And that'll do for part one. We'll be back in a second.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We've got a live show, everybody, and we still haven't sold out London or Manchester, mainly because those venues are bigger before the people who are playing Bristol and Dublin and Brighton get full of themselves. Ellis James, Troy Townsend, Philippe Auclair in London on the 13th of November, John Bruin, Nader Manuha, and the Will Unwin anecdote in Manchester on the 15th. The live stream is the 22nd in Brighton. So wherever you are in the world, you can watch it. Tickets are on sale at theguardian.com/FWTour23. Please come along. The home nations, it's really Scotland, isn't it? Who have a, you know, they're in such a brilliant position. 1-5 from five, Robin. It's sort of mad when you look at they've got Spain and Norway in their group. And maybe they got them at a good time early on, but they go to Spain tonight. And they've got a friendly on Tuesday against France. They don't care about that. Spain have improved since that defeat. But it probably doesn't matter.
No, well, I think the good thing is Scotland don't, if they lose, they still could qualify and they still probably will. So it's great for them because it's not like they have to go there and think, oh God, we've got to get a result. So actually they could probably play without a bit of fear. I think Spain probably will win. They've got this ridiculous record. I think the last home Euro qualifying defeat was in 2003 for them. You know, they obviously got incredible players and they, you know, they are going to be heavy favourites, but I'm still not that impressed with them. And the last few tournaments, I did them at the Nations League in the summer and they have got better since then. But it's possession for no purpose. And I feel like that's still a little bit the case. It's a kind of cliche, but they're not a great watch.
Are you saying Spain need to get it launched? Is that what you're
Absolutely,
suggesting?
Yeah. John Bruin TM. They do. And Scotland have Scott McTominay, who is the second highest scorer in qualifying. He's got more goals than Haaland, than Kane. It's Lukaku is leading it. He's got six. I mean, and he's, you know, obviously got, he won the game for Man United. I mean, he's going to be on top of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, he scored both in the 2-0 win over Spain, Ed. I mean, sort of, we touched on it on Monday, but have I been misreading some Scott McTominay? Like, I don't know where to place him because I did probably slightly foolishly just put him in a McFred, he's quite good, but he's not quite good enough bracket. And I might be completely wrong.
I think for Scotland, he plays a bit more advanced. So I don't watch many of their matches, but he obviously gets into goal scoring positions and is quite good at putting the ball away. And that's what happened for United at the weekend, wasn't he? He came off the bench with no time left and got himself in the box and got on the end of a couple of balls. And yeah, fair play to him. And I think Scotland, it's a great story under Steve Clarke because he really has transformed them. He's an amazing manager, I think. When he was in the Premier League, it was a while ago now, isn't it? But that West Brom team, I think they came in the top 10. And then he had a bad start to the next season and was gone. And that was it, really, pretty much for him. And his amazing experience, you know, worked under Mourinho at Chelsea at the first time around. And he's really transformed Scotland into a real force. And yeah, I suppose McTominay is sort of the symbol of that sort of swashbuckling style and really amazing athlete. You remember he was posting his 5K times in, it was during lockdown. They were really, really quick, like 16 minutes or something like that. Oh,
that's ridiculous. That's winning a park run, isn't it?
You know, yeah, absolutely. But he's what he is. Number one, I think he's a proper athlete who maybe not the technically the best, but it's working for Scotland.
Wales beat Gibraltar 4-0 in a friendly yesterday. That's ahead of playing Croatia on Sunday. And looking at it, they are on 7 points from five, same as Armenia. Turkey are on 10 points from five, Croatia 10 points from four. Ben Davis, Kiefer Moore with two, and Nathan Broadhead Will Gibraltar be disappointed with that pool? Going to our Gibraltar expert.
Well, Gibraltar are in a mess. They're in an absolute mess. They're obviously a very small nation and they're punched above their weight for a lot of their history. But yeah, they're in a really bad state. And there's a real feeling of frustration, I think, amongst Gibraltarian fans that they're going backwards. They've got a coach who's picking unpopular players, sort of picking his men over slightly more interesting options. And you've got an FA that's pretty much not functioning. For example, they didn't send a women's team to the Nations League because basically they didn't want to. The men in charge didn't want to. They wanted to save the money, I think. So they were the only team, I think, in the whole of Europe. Although San Marino maybe don't have a women's team. But basically they opted not to send a women's team, which was a really terrible gesture. So Gibraltarian football is in a pretty low ebb, which is a shame because they really have defied expectations and got some incredible results when you look back in the past.
An eye-catching performance from Charlie, son of Robbie Savage, for Wales there. So, yeah, Croatia is a big game for them. And then Northern Ireland and Ireland are really, really basically out of it. Northern Ireland will no longer be able to qualify if they fail to beat San Marino on Saturday off Denmark and Slovenia win their games. But you know, that gives them more hope than you would suggest. They have 3 points from 6 games. The Republic of Ireland have 3 points from 5 games. And are a long way behind the France, Netherlands and Greece. They play Greece and then Gibraltar Friday and Monday. Hey, Paul, you're flying to Mongolia. Tell us why. What are you going to do?
I am. So I'm off to watch their qualifier. So the Asian football qualifiers are absolutely brutal. For the lowest ranked teams, they start today. In fact, if you're listening on Thursday, they start today, the first legs. And it's 10 games. So the lowest ranked teams play in these 10 games. That's 2 legs. And if you lose, you're out. That's your World Cup already finished. And it's an absolutely brutal system. Mongolia have drawn Afghanistan. So I will be going out to see them play. And the reason for that is I once owned a football team in Mongolia. I co-owned a football team for about 3 years there. Totally accidentally, sort of a series of odd events led to me owning this football club. So I'm going back out to see this team try and get through the first round, which is going to be really tricky for them. They're definitely underdogs. But they've come a long way in that they lost 14-0 to Japan in 2021, Mongolia. But they've actually started to piece things together lately. And they're, one of their star players is a kid called Gamba. He's actually, I think he's not a kid anymore. But we, when I was working in Mongolia, we brought him to Barnet in 2017 to have a month playing there. And it was kind of an amazing thing for this kid. He'd grown up, his training was like chopping wood in minus 20 degrees. It was proper rocky stuff, you know, the one with Ivan Drago. But he was a tiny little guy, but really skillful little winger. And he had no opportunities outside of Mongolia to really sort of further his potential. But he was obviously the wonder kid of Mongolian football. So we got him over to Barnet for a month and he did brilliantly. He scored a few goals. He scored against Jose Mourinho's son, who was in goal for Fulham at the time. And he almost, I think he could have signed except for the visa issues. And then he went back to become the first professional Mongolian player in Europe. So he was at Pushkas Academy. So it'd be really nice to like meet up with some of these guys again and see some people that I spent 3 years of sort of very hard experience trying to run a club in Mongolia with.
In the Guardian book, right? Can read more about it.
There is a little bit of that in the book, yes. So what I will say is after the time I was there, so 2018, Mongolia had what I would regard as the harshest World Cup qualification campaign in history. In then 2018, their campaign for World Cup 2018, they lost to East Timor. So it was, again, just one two-legged match. They lost to East Timor and quite comfortably. But East Timor packed their team with Brazilians who were actually not properly naturalised.
Ringers?
Yeah, ringers. They were total ringers. Mongolia were out. They moved on. East Timor then, I think, got knocked out by someone. And then FIFA said, oh, yeah, that was completely wrong. Sorry about that. But it was too late. So Mongolia were already out. And that was their qualification campaign. Oh, kind of shows how hard it is, isn't it, really, for these teams.
Ed, you wanted to mention Pakistan's first game at home since 2007.
Yeah, I should just say it's 2014. My fault initially, I said that it was 2007, but I've done some more research on this. And yeah, it's really, really interesting. I mean, talking about teams that are on a bad run, they have lost their last 12 matches and haven't been able to play at home competitively anyway, since 2014 because of issues with the Football Federation. You know, they're still under a normalisation committee in Pakistan. They have been for the last 4 years. But hopefully this is going to be the start of something big because, as Paul mentioned just now, that they've got the first leg of their qualifier away against Cambodia on Thursday. And fingers crossed that there's going to be something to play for in the second leg when they come back to Islamabad on Tuesday. Now, the game has to be played in the daytime because they have the floodlights there aren't good enough to play in the evening. So they've got to kick off at 2 o'clock, but apparently it's not going to be too hot at that time. And there's four British-based players, including Issa Suleiman, who used to play for Aston Villa. Actually, sorry, he's not British-based anymore, but he was. He's now playing in Azerbaijan. And there's a guy called Otis Khan who plays for Grimsby at the moment. He's been at Sheffield United in the past. And it's really, really exciting. You know, imagine that. The first time in nearly 10 years that the fans are going to get to see their team at home. They've been having to play in other countries since then just because of some of the issues in Pakistan as well, politically. But yeah, fingers crossed they can at least give themselves a chance of getting through this qualifier.
Dave says, can Paul please let me know how the Cosray side are getting on? Despite getting one of their lovely tops, I have to admit I've not kept up to date with every kick of the ball.
Well, the Cosray team, so very, very tiny island in Micronesia, 6,000 people, didn't have a football when they entered the competition this summer, their first ever futsal competition, went to the tournament and then finished as runners-up. So it was a bit of a miraculous effort, really, from them. They did have a fair few Cosrayans who live on the bigger island of Pompeii, so it wasn't quite the miracle it sounds like. But yeah, football's going strong in Micronesia. And I'm going to do another shameless plug.
Please do.
Yeah, I have a podcast called The Sweeper with Lee Wingate, and we talk about the more obscure outposts of football. And I'm actually writing a sequel to my book, Up Pompeii, about me coaching the world's lowest ranked football team in Micronesia. And it's a sequel to that, which brings it up to date, including the world's biggest defeat in history of world football, which took place just after I left, I like to say, and goes all the way up to today. So yeah, if you want to listen to at Sweeper Pod, and I'm writing my sequel, which is only available to people who sign up to the Patreon for The Sweeper.
Well, go and do that, everybody. Lawrence says, will Max's vendetta and ill will towards Luton now end after they signed a pod contributor's son? Andros, most well known for being son of panellist Troy Townsend, has joined Luton. Good signing. Wish him the best of luck. Listen, I said it'd be funny if Luton got no points. I also would love Luton to stay up. Now they've got some points. I think it'd be absolutely, it would be marvellous if they managed it. We mentioned on Tuesday's EFL pod, it looked likely that Wayne Rooney would become the Birmingham manager. He has done that. And lots of people pointing out that Jamie Vardy and Wayne Rooney come face to face on the 16th of December when Birmingham take on Leicester at home. This has happened before, I think, since sort of Agatha Christie. So it shouldn't be the headlines that...
Not since the trial, I don't think. That'll be the first time.
Is it not since the trial?
Well, yeah. He's been in the States, hasn't he? So.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so something to look out for.
One for your diary.
Not all Birmingham fans totally enthused, as we discussed on Tuesday. And John says, not a question, just a shout out to Norwich's fantastic World Mental Health Day video. One of the best bits of awareness raising I've seen this area for a long time. I mean, it's been viewed, Robin, hundreds of millions of times, I think. And it's interesting with these videos, isn't it? Sometimes you just get it right. And I think some people, I mean, if you haven't seen the video, you know, it's two men sitting next to each other, clearly don't know each other, but go to the game. And then, yeah, maybe I don't want to give it away, but it's worth watching, isn't it?
Oh, superb. You know, there's when you're scrolling and, you know, you see a video and it's like 2 minutes, you know, with our attention spans, usually you're like, nah, this is going to be too long. But it is, it's well worth watching. Just what a great job they've done, because it's so simple, but it's really quite affecting and poignant, and it just a reminder to check in on everyone, and you don't know what's going on, you know, in people's heads. It's just, as I said, simple, effective, and just absolutely brilliant. So well done to everyone involved with that.
Totally, yeah. It is okay not to be okay, and that'll do for part two. Part three, Kieran Maguire and Kevin Day from the Price of Football podcast will join us to plug their book shamelessly.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So we've plugged our own book enough. Let's plug someone else's book. Unfit and Improper Persons, An Idiot's Guide to Owning a Football Club, by Kieran Maguire and Kevin Day, and their producer, Gar Keelty, from the Price of Football podcast, which is an excellent podcast. And Kieran and Kevin join us now. Hey, Kieran.
Hi, I'm Max. It's a sunny morning here in Liverpool.
Lovely. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Nice to see. We normally, when there's a football finance issue, Kevin, we normally go to Kieran before you, Kev. I hope you're not insulted.
No, I think it's the very best thing you could possibly do. As I keep telling random strangers in the street who have taken to stopping me to ask about amortization, so you've got the wrong one.
Why did you write the book, Kev?
I'm not very good at business matters, and so I didn't realise that I actually had a two-book deal with Bloomsbury. So I wrote my first book, which came out 3 years ago today, and then I had a phone call from my publisher, Matt, who was lovely, to say about the second book. I went, oh, that's great. And he said, no, we have to. It's in the contract. Right. And he suggested that we do a book based on the podcast. And basically, we wanted to do a snapshot of the financial state of modern football, but we didn't want to do a textbook because, A, Kieran's already written the classic textbook, if you like, about football finances. And B, we just didn't want to do a book that was like chapter one, transfer fees, chapter two, the women's game. So we came up with this idea of creating a fictional football club, West Park Rovers, a Sunday League team, and taking that team from the Sunday League into the Europa Conference. It was going to be the Champions League, but Bloomsbury rather strangely said, well, that stretches credulity a bit too far. So, well, it's a fiction. It's a made-up club. We can do what we want with it, surely. So it's just an excuse. It's just a way of using that to examine the finances of football at every level, right from the very start, Sunday League, which is a very expensive place to be, right through all the divisions, but also as a way. So, yeah, we create a women's football team, and that we use that as an excuse to examine how the finances of women's football. We talk about our academy team and so on and so forth. So the reason we decided to do it, apart from being asked and being financially and legally obliged to do so, was that I think, and I partly blame Kieran for this, I think football fans in the past 2 or 3 years, in a way that never existed when I was a younger fan, have become obsessed with the finances of football. And partly to do with the grossly unfair distribution of the money in the game, partly due, I think, to things like the Super League, but partly due to existential panic on the part of most football fans that their club may not exist this time next year. I mean, we started the podcast in the run-up to Bury going out of business, and I think we touched a nerve because we were so angry about it, because Kieran was the only person out there giving the details of what was happening to Bury and how it could be stopped. And I think football fans all over the world kind of tuned into that. When I was going to Palace as a kid, as a teenager, you didn't care. I knew that my club was owned by an accountant who ran a meat business. But the only reason I knew that is that every now and again, we would sign a player on the pitch at halftime, and there'd be a cow carcass hanging next to him. because Ray Bloy wanted to remind people what he did for a living.
And hopefully you could tell the difference, right? That's the key.
What, between the player and the cow?
Yes, yes.
Occasionally, yeah. But we had, you know, most club owners were then local, the classic phrase, local boys made good, but you had no interest in how your club was run, and you had no fear that it was going to go out of business. But I think that's changed, and I think this book provides a service to those people who aren't accountants, who are, you know, fascinated, worried, obsessed about their club's football finances. And hopefully this book is a funny way of explaining what's going on at every level of football in terms of the money.
And Kieran, there is a good bit about the history of owners, because, like, as Kev alludes to there, there is this idea, I guess in all football, our football used to be great and it's not great anymore. But like the owners are worse now and you hark back to like the dodgy local businessman. Was it better then or we just didn't know or care?
I think there were fewer zeros at the end of the numbers in terms of what the clubs were losing. It was just bad. If you go back to the 90s and the noughties, the number of clubs that were going into administration, sometimes there'd be 6, 7, 8 in a single season. And I think we do have a romantic notion. And again, if you go back a generation, Accrington Stanley was lost to football many years ago. We lost Hereford United. All of these clubs that are so central to their local towns and cities. Football's always been associated with dodgy money. It was simply a case of we didn't have 24-hour carpet bombing in terms of social media, in terms of people being willing to highlight them. And we didn't have the fans getting organised the way that they do today. Some of the work that's been undertaken by fans at Charlton and Sunderland and other clubs into people who come in on a wave of publicity, and then you start digging behind them. So we felt, in terms of books, that there's not enough idiots in football already running clubs. So let's just add a couple from South London.
Is it possible to buy/own a football club, make money, and be a good owner, Kieran?
You can do 2 out of 3, but as Meatloaf said, that's about as far as it goes. There are plenty of good owners out there, and. We tend to focus on, the likes of Jason Stockwood at Grimsby and Andy Holt at Accrington and Mark Palios at Tranmere Rovers and so on, they get it, they understand it. But even so, they all say, I'm doing it, but it's going to cost me £500,000 a year. And they'll go to the fans and say, this is how much I'm prepared to put in. If you want the club run by somebody else, then I'm out of here. And most fans, I think, do buy into that, but do we actually want sustainable football? Because I think, I can't remember the name of the guy, but some bloke was talking about having long-term strategic decisions in this country instead of short-term ones. But as football fans, we're going, no, just pile in, just spend all of our money on an unknown 22-year-old from Belgium and he's going to solve all of our problems. And if it doesn't work out, then they forget that they put the club really at ransom and in a very difficult position.
Kev, have you? I mean, it's like as the title of the book suggests. There's so much about fit and proper, and this kind of banging your head against a brick wall every time you hear about an owner who has passed this test and is guilty of either horrendous human rights abuses right at the top to just like fraud and every possible an asset stripping at the bottom. Does it ever surprise you? Have you ever seen anyone fail it? I can't think of anyone who has.
The irony is of our fictional football club is that Kieran probably would fail the fit and proper persons test because he's intelligent, sensible, and knows about the finances of a football club. I would probably pass it because I'm not in prison. Which currently the bottom line seems to be of the FFP rules in both the Premier League and the EFL, as long as you're not actively now in prison, you're pretty fine. And we see it with Birmingham City. It's not just in terms of the financial decisions that are wrongly taken by some clubs and not every club. We spoke to the chair of Exeter City Supporters Trust this week, and Exeter are a fantastic, well-run fan-owned club, and there's another argument about how far a fan-owned club can go, and they're great. And you talk to somebody like them and you get really passionate and enthusiastic about the game being in safe hands. And then you see the owners of Birmingham City, who are perfectly sensible financially, sacking the manager on a whim because they fancy getting Wayne Rooney in. Then there's nothing that the authorities can do about people like that.
What do you think the motivation is actually for a lot of these owners to own a football club? You get it if it's a Tony Bloom, obviously it's his club and he'll swallow losses because they're doing so well. I just don't understand why anyone would want to, like someone who's got no connection.
What you actually find, we think that football is a big industry, but it's not. Yeah, I can buy a football club for £1. Steve Dale did that to Bury. We saw a guy called David Hilton, who I think it's fair to say has a colourful backstory. He acquired Scunthorpe United Football Club for £3. And for a very small investment, you get an awful lot of attention. If we take a look at what's happening in other industries, Microsoft has just bought a games company, Activision, for $70 billion. You could buy every single Premier League club for that. But look at the amount of attention that Jim Ratcliffe and Sheikh Jassim. We had a story break in the last day or so about a guy called William Story, who is bidding to buy Reading Football Club, supposedly for $50 million. He's in four or five of the newspapers today. You wouldn't do that if you were buying a furniture show, a furniture shop, or a plastic box company for exactly the same amount of money. So you get the ego. Everybody in the town knows who you are. There's only 92 owners. It's a very exclusive club, and it's a very cheap entry point to get into that club.
Just wanted to ask about multi-club ownership, and obviously it's the here and present danger at the moment, or depending on where you stand on the issue, really. But do you think that it is a system that could work potentially? Obviously, you mentioned Crystal Palace there, Kevin, and John Textor obviously has a few clubs. And also his plans to potentially float that group on the stock market in the US in the future. Do you think it's a dangerous precedent potentially for our football, or it could be a good thing?
I think it's really interesting. I think there are people at UEFA who are genuinely concerned about the multi-club ownership model, because if you get a club that eventually has an interest in 25, 30 clubs in Europe, that becomes a separate power block that is a danger to UEFA's decision-making process. The thing with Palace is John Textor is trying to implement a multi-club ownership thing when he doesn't own Crystal Palace. He only owns 40% of Crystal Palace, which he says he regrets. He says he wishes that he bought the whole club because he has a large stake but no influence. But we've reached a stage as Palace fans that it's bad enough worrying about Palace's finance and Palace's future. But every time we see a story about the clubs that John Textor also has an interest in Botafogo and Lyon, you start to worry because you think, well, how is that going to influence us? If he's struggling, as he clearly is struggling financially with those other clubs, What does that mean for us? And then, of course, the conspiracy theories start, because we don't buy enough players in the transfer window. And everyone says, that's because John Textor can't afford it. Or the exchange rate between the Brazilian currency and English currency is fluctuating, so he can't. So it's a model that makes me very uneasy. But I know, again, I will pass this to Kieran for the correct economic answer.
There are financial benefits. You get continuity of approach. Therefore, if you've got a promising player, you can send him to your club in Belgium or your club in Uruguay, and they're going to be trained, they're going to have the same sports science, they're going to have the same culture of development, and then you can take them to the mothership. So that makes a lot of sense. There was something called Brexit, which happened a few years ago, which is actually turns out to be an absolute disaster in terms of English football clubs, because you can no longer bring players at the ages of 16 and 17 from Europe. Fabregas came to Arsenal, 16 or 17? We've seen other players come across. Well, under the new rules, players can't move to England until they're 18. So therefore, by having your multi-club team in Belgium or Portugal, you now recruit them, you park them there for a couple of years, and then you bring them to the club. So this is sort of a bit of a practical solution. I think the issue is going to arise that if we've got the FIFA World Club Championship, which is now going to involve 32 teams, well, you're going to have real conflicts of interest there. Because your Asian team could end up playing your European team. And in terms of the integrity of sport, if you've got two clubs owned by the same person, then there's issues. We've already seen in Saudi Arabia Pro League, we've got four teams which are owned by PIF. Well, yeah, eyebrows will be raised at some of the results there. And economically, it makes sense. You get economies of scale. You get all of these sort of, you know, the textbook benefits. But football isn't like any other industry, because we still have an element of romance in the game, and that's destroyed to a certain extent by MCOs.
Kieran, how do we stop bad owners? I mean, this is quite a big question. Like, is the regulator the right thing? Is the German model the right thing? The dream is what? That every club has fan ownership, fans on the board. And at the moment, you know, Cambridge are really well run, right? They listen to the fans, they're in a really great position, and they weren't for a long time. But we're just beholden to, it's luck, right? If you're a fan at the moment.
I think what we can do is that we can nudge things in the right direction. So the regulator will make it more difficult for Ryan's. And, you know, in terms of the owners and directors test, we do speak to the EFL on quite a regular basis on the quiet. And I know of quite a few people who they've prevented from coming into football. So I think we are slowly moving in the right direction. But it's a bit like having a house. If you stick a burglar alarm on the side of it, it's not going to stop your house being burgled, but hopefully they're going to move on to somewhere else. So if we make football less desirable for Romans, then yeah, it's a terrible thing. Then they can go to rugby, or they can go to another sport, or they go, yeah. And I don't want anybody to have to deal with these people, but ultimately football is my sport, and we'll shift them across.
You do in the book, Kev. It is noted that Kieran has never done a poo at a football stadium. Will your fictional club have no cubicles because that's Kieran's policy?
Do you know what, Bloom? If you've ever visited Bloomsbury's offices, these lovely 18th century Georgian townhouse offices, it's a very classy place, Bloomsbury, and all the people who work there are very classy. So Kieran casually suggested to me that perhaps we could mention this story about him never having a poo at a football ground. And I went, well, I'll put it in, Kieran, but there's absolutely no chance that the good people at Bloomsbury... The good people at Bloomsbury, I love Dave. Oh, this is a wonderful story. We have to include this. This will show that we're down with the average football fan. Again, I'm going to have to pass you to Kieran for the grown-up answer, because I've happily had... Well, not happily, because no, let's face it,
no, definitely not happily.
No one, unless they really, really have to, will go to a male toilet. I can never understand. I remember going to QPR once a long, long time ago, and commenting on the fact that there's no toilet paper in the cubicle, and somebody said there's loads of toilet paper, but it's in the waste paper bin, which is like, A, there's a waste paper bin, but B,
wow.
Well, I don't know why this happens. It's 2023, but male football fans seem to resent toilet roll hanging happily from a toilet roll holder and have to place it somewhere else.
Yeah, of course. Shove it all down the toilet, for one, don't they?
Kieran says he's from South London, but Kieran's, you know, he's gone Sussex, basically. So Kieran's a rather effete football fan. So he will explain to you why he's never...
Does this mean, Kieran, you've not actually eaten anything? Do you not eat at football grounds? You've never eaten something slightly suspect then?
Oh, don't open that can of vegetarian worms.
I think I had a traumatic experience on the one and only time I went to Plough Lane, which was 1985. And the state of the... And I don't drink alcohol. I'm sort of semi-conscious about what I eat. And I saw the state of the toilets there, and I think it's affected my subconscious,
right. Yeah,
has therefore just closed down whenever I get sort of, there's an amber warning sign when I'm near a ground.
Yeah, it's a bit like on a train, isn't it? Like, do you know what the thing is? I find it funny, but I can't recall ever doing it. I mean, I must have done, but I can't recall it. Timmy says, which pod member is most likely to fail the unfit and improper person's test and why? I don't think we need to answer that question, Timmy, do we? We all know the answer. Listen, chaps, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate your time. And good luck with the book. Thanks, Kieran.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kev.
Thanks, Max. Lovely to see you all. Thanks for having us on.
On the subject of books, the Football Weekly book is out now, so don't buy their heap of shite. They're still here. You can get 15% off if you go to the Guardian Bookshop, guardianbookshop.com/football-weekly-book. But buy theirs too, of course. Just a couple of AOBs, because I'm sure it's a very long podcast. Andrew says, just wanted to add a plus one to the anti-dog movement that your pod now spearheads. Blimey. We need some balance, anyone, if anybody wants to pile in. A hand up from Ed Ahrens. It was refreshing to hear. It's not just me who believes they have a right to not have a dog bound up to them in a park. What's next on the agenda? I was worried we're going to get cancelled, Ed. We haven't had that much hate, but please.
I'm sure that my dog would not be enjoyed by non-dog lovers, because she's very greedy. She's a beagle and she bounds up to everybody. And right. But she's lovely. She's got really soft ears and she's very friendly.
Yeah. Do you know, after I said that on the pod, I sat in Edinburgh Gardens in North Melbourne with a lovely dog called Bob. It was a friend of mine. And I thought, oh, maybe I was wrong about dogs, because this dog was very placid and lovely. Rose finally says, dear Max, Barry and the gang, I thought you'd like to know, not everyone is having a vasectomy while listening to you. The pod is also extremely useful to combat the misery of seasickness. Despite a long naval history in my family, I once got seasick standing on a jetty. I'm currently working in Tokelau, which I presume, Paul, you've managed them at some point in your life.
Near Samoa, yeah. Isn't it? It's one of the few places in the world without a football team, in fact.
Oh, wow. The only way to get home is a two-day boat ride to Samoa. I'm currently stockpiling the pod to get me through the misery fest, pit of doom that will be my bunk. Please make it funny, but not too funny, as I will have pulled all my stomach muscles chundering. Wishing you all a safe week on lovely dry land. That is Rose. Thank you, Rose. Good luck to you and anyone else who would like to send us stories of seasickness or just vomiting while listening. I hope we don't get too many replies to that. footballweekly@theguardian.com is our email address, and that'll do for today. Thanks, Ed.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray with Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson.
This is The Guardian.